Good morning. I'm Greg Priggett, and I know lots of you, but if you don't know me, I'm the missions pastor here at Rose Drive, and I have the privilege of introducing our speaker, Steve Gamir. Now, this last couple of weeks, lots of people have been asking me, how did we get involved with Partners? How did that whole situation start? Well, I need to take you on a little journey. So many of you know that we have been involved with Mission Aviation Fellowship, the Bush Pilots, for lots and lots of years. And I had the privilege of serving on their board, and at the point there, I met Brad Hazlett, who we got to hear from about 18 months ago, and Brad was the Asian director for MAF. And he was, I would meet with him, and he started telling me about this organization called Partners and the work that was going on in Burma. And I knew nothing about the situation in Burma. I knew nothing about that there were tens of thousands of people in camps in Thailand because they had fled from Burma. And then eventually Brad comes and says, you know, I'm leaving MAF because I'm going to be joining Partners. And I'm all, what? You're a pilot. Come on. God's leading you to do that. And he goes, if you would ever just come and see the work, you'd understand what I mean. So I was given the opportunity to go and see the work, and he was exactly right. And a bunch of us got to go and be part of a team that went and done there, gone there. And in fact, we're taking another team there in a couple of weeks, and we got to meet Steve. And Steve's life was totally transformed because of one encounter that he had with one grandmother. And we're going to get to hear about that, and you'll see why that we as a church count it a privilege to literally be part of Partners team, to walk with them, to pray with them, and to support them. And so Steve is married to Adni. They live in Oslo, Norway. So this is a big time of the year for them with the Winter Olympics. If you haven't noticed, they're cleaning up already and having a good time with that. And has three daughters. And it's just a joy to have Steve here. So thanks for being here. Share from your heart, brother.
Thanks, Greg. Back in August in Kurdish Syria, it was 130 degrees outside in the Nineveh Desert. And I was in the area of Raqqa. Raqqa was the last big stronghold of ISIS in the Middle East. The final fight for Raqqa was happening when we were there, or I was there. And we were there, I was there with a team of Kurdish Syrians visiting locations, finding out what the leaders of this movement thought we could do to help them. And meeting with those leaders, the first thing that they said consistently was, we need help with our children. There's thousands of orphans, and furthermore, there's thousands of kids who are just traumatized because they've either been subject to or witnessed terrible ISIS violence, and we need help to get them back on their feet. And along with the other things that they asked us for help for, that was something that really rung for us because it's something that we've been doing for many years in Myanmar. In fact, for the past 15 years, we've partnered with a mentor named Glenn Totten. Glenn, could you stand? He's a trauma therapist. He's here this morning with us. And Glenn's helped us be healing and hope for little kids who have seen the wrong side of our reality on earth, war. And so when I was in Raqqa, I asked if I could meet some of the children that they thought we should help, and they said, of course you can. So we went on a trip and walked through the courtyard of this one grandmother with three siblings. And as we walked in, the grandmother started crying and wailing. And I didn't know what she was saying, but I felt pretty uncomfortable. And as she was crying and shouting, it was more like shouting, we sat down on this slab of preheated 130-degree concrete, and Grandma was sitting right in front of me, and then three siblings, her grandkids, were sitting to my right. Two of them are on the screen. And I asked our translator, what is it that she's saying? And she said, what this grandmother is saying is, what good is it to see another white guy and tell another white guy what we've been through? Why do we do this? It's not going to bring back the lives of our loved ones, my daughter and my son-in-law, And when they leave, we will still be hungry. And she was upset that we were there to visit. And so when I heard that, I took the camera off from around my shoulder, which was dumb to begin with. I should have not walked in with it. And I put my black notebook and my pen away because I realized I looked like a journalist and Grandma had seen a few of those. And I told her, your government, Grandma, asked us if we would help with children who have been through the kind of violence that your grandkids have been through. And so we're here to meet you, but you don't have to tell us your story, and neither do your children have to talk to us, your grandchildren. We really just want to meet you and tell you that we care and that we're working to put together programs to help your grandchildren and you yourself. And I also said there's people all over the world who are praying for them. And Rose Drive Church, Rose Drive Friends Church, you were a part of that statement. And so the grandmother looked down at the concrete and then pointed at her nose. She reflected a little, pointed at her nose and said, when they came into our house or our apartment, they shot me in the face. And she said, look at my nose. And so I looked at her nose and I said, I'm terribly sorry. That must have been terrible. And then they shot me here, and she pulled up her skirt and showed me a bullet wound on her hip. And they thought that I was dead, which is probably why I lived through this attack. I fell over and was unconscious for some time. But before I was unconscious, they brutally murdered in front of me and my grandkids, my daughter and my son-in-law. And then she was unconscious. And then she said they went to my oldest granddaughter and held her and pulled a knife out and cut her index finger off. Then they went to my 9-month-old granddaughter and attempted to cut her right leg off with a knife. And I saw the scar tissue on this child. I watched her hobble into the room. She's permanently disabled because of what happened to her. And then after this terrible violence, they left. They invested the currency of fear. This is why this small group of men and fighting women have so much power. It's fear-based. They deposited that little investment of fear in this family, and they left, carrying on doing the same thing over and over and over again. While I was in Kurdish Syria, I heard this story multiple times. And this is not an exceptional story. This is normal. And even worse things that I saw on video that I wish I could get out of my head, that people showed me because they wanted me to see just how bad it is and what they have survived. And so with this grandmother, when I heard this story, I said that we care. Rose Drive Friends Church, you were there when I said we care. You were there when I prayed for them. You were there when I offered a sum of money so that when we left, she wouldn't be hungry. You were there when I promised to set up a school. When on behalf of our team, we promised to be there for these children who have suffered this intolerable violence. And that we're there because it's proof of the fact that we love God and that God's alive. He's still on the stage here. The proof is our love for our neighbor, right? And so when we left, this grandmother embraced me and gave me a hug, and the children, the grandchildren were very happy, and we left. You were there. You've supported us, and you've helped us and empowered us to do this. Well, back up to 1994, when my wife and I, Audney, hiked into a refugee camp called Shoglo Refugee Camp. There were 9,000 people living in this camp, and for us, it was the first time to see this kind of destitution. I mean, the material poverty is one thing. People living in bamboo shacks that were meant to last one rainy season, and they've been in them for 5 or 6 years. No toilets or very few, and those that were there were just holes, primitive holes in the ground. One stream servicing 9,000 people with drinking water, cooking water, bathing water, toothbrushing water, everything. That's one arresting piece, the material thing. But the other thing was the intense sadness of people who had survived trauma, landmine victims, sexual violence, people walking around with one leg or one eye, all of these children with distended bellies, because when their villages are destroyed, their whole routine of health and hygiene is gone with it, and they drink water that they haven't boiled. They eat food that is not properly cared for, and they end up with these terrible parasites in their tummies, these worms that grow so big that it fills the stomach cavity and makes them look kind of overweight. Problem is, they have these toothpick little legs. They're not wearing pants or underwear, the ones that I met, most of them even to this day. They're barefoot. They have lesions on their legs because of insect bites. That's bed bugs or other insects that bite them. They scratch them and they get infected. That most of the kids in the camp in 1994 were bald because they get bed bugs or they get lice. Their heads are shaved to take care of the lice, leaving behind these open wounds that they've continued to scratch. For me, it was the first time to see a complete denial of justice to a whole bunch of wonderful Christians and non-Christian people. It was the first time to make friends with people who had survived not just violence and poverty, but the loss of their own country. And on our third visit to this particular refugee camp, we met this wonderful woman named Rose. And Rose was Jesus Christ. It turns out Jesus is a slightly overweight, beautiful Burmese woman. And whenever you got close to Rose's hut, her shack, you would hear laughter. There was always laughter coming out of Rose's shack, constant laughter. And if you got near her shack, you would see that she has swept the dirt from the dirt and made clean dirt. And she has planted flowers in recycled pots or munition shells or whatever she could find. She's planted beautiful flowers. Now, this is a refugee who's survived hell on earth. In fact, she survived 9 months in a notorious prison, being violated terribly and tortured and so forth. She's very lucky to even be alive. She got out of that 9 months of prison and came to this camp, back to the camp where her and her husband set up the first medical facility in Shoglo refugee camp. Her husband was a medical practitioner, and she found her husband dead. He tried to get her out of prison. He knew what was happening to her. He got depressed, drank himself to death. One of his interns that he trained gave him an injection of diazepam. The dose was too high, and his heart stopped. So here's this woman who survives hell on earth, comes to a refugee camp, and around whose hut is life and beautiful flowers. And furthermore, she started a meeting forum for victims of sexual violence and got them together to help restore dignity with one another. She started small development projects that her husband had initiated. She started more and more of them. She started a school for kids who were not able, because of disorders of various kinds and trauma, they were not able to get into the regular refugee camp school. So she started a program for them to try to help their parents. This lady was a one-woman Jesus machine. And when I met her, I felt deficient. I felt that something was lacking in me. Well, on the third visit, we're sitting on the floor of her hut, bamboo hut, drinking tea from a dirty cup. And we said, who is this child, this 3 or 4 year old little girl that's sleeping on the floor here? And she said that the pro-democracy soldiers went to her village to find survivors and document what happened. And so when they got there, they found the village had been destroyed, and there were bunches of dead people around. A whole bunch of the village had run into the jungle, and who knows how many of them survived to this day or from that day. But they did find one survivor in a hiding place, and it was this 3 or 4 year old little girl. I don't know her age, and no one does, because there's no birth certificates or hospitals in this part of the world. There's no wheels or cars. There's no electricity, no light bulbs, no oil, nothing round. There's just water buffalo and people trying to live off the land growing rice. Problem is, they're born where there's vast natural resources. It's gold, molybdenum, tin, silver, emeralds, rubies, blood rubies. They come from Burma. Jade, some of the most sought-after jade in the world, and then oil and natural gas and all of the resources that come out of the ground. Unfortunately, this tribe, the Karen people, 5 million people, were born on top of that resource. And them, like many other ethnic groups in Myanmar, they face the violence of a regime that is totalitarian in their use of force and taking away these resources or strategically protecting them. And so there's this little girl sleeping on the floor, and we said, Rose, what's her story? She told us her story, and she said the soldiers found her and carried her across the Moy River, the natural boundary between Thailand and Burma, down the Shoglo stream, and whose door did they knock on to take this kid in? Oh, Jesus Christ, of course. That's the one who they knocked on. They knocked on Rose's door and said, would you please foster this child? And Rose, of course, said yes. And we showed up some days later, and she told us this story. And she looked up at us, and she said, would you help me help this child and kids like this that are falling through the cracks because of this terrible war? Did you know that the war's been going on in Myanmar for more than 50 years? It's the most protracted. It's the longest-running civil war on the planet. And up until recently, it was the biggest, most violent crisis on the planet. And so we're introduced to this war, and we're introduced to one little girl who's a victim. And we were asked if we could be part of this, the lifeline for this child. And we said yes. Now, when you say yes to one little child, what happens? So you say, okay, we'll take this one. Well, it's $30. That's how much it costs. $30 for a year, not a month. We had to get her set up with a blanket and towel and clothes and flip-flops, sandals for the rainy season so she wouldn't get parasites, a coin for the offering plate. It's just super basic things she needed to integrate into this family of Roses. Well, within a few months, we had like 13 kids, and within a year, there were 24, and within 4 years, we had well over 1,000 children in 12 homes and 8 refugee camps. So here's a little secret. Don't say yes. Unless you want to have a whole lot of fun. And so it from there, from that first little girl, and then on to this snowballing thing, we got more and more involved in addressing the causes of displacement, the causes of this violence, the causes of them being refugees, and finding ways to intervene so that they could experience free, full lives. Freedom and fullness comes from John 10:10. That's the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy, right? And what did Jesus come to do? Came to bring abundant life. And so we started Partners as a means, as a way of standing and having a legal platform to help these children and to help these families. At the same time that all this was happening, we decided to reread the Bible. And I told you, I realized that I had a deficient understanding. There was something wrong. I missed the plot somehow. Now, I thought I had the plot pretty well nailed down. I had read the Bible 7 times cover to cover and memorized the first 3 chapters of Romans. I fasted a week and practically levitated. Somehow between when I gave my life to Christ and as a young adult, somehow it went from being about learning who God is and being faithful to do what He wants me to do to being something about me and proving that I'm better than you. It's weird how that works. Well, I'm with these refugees, and I realize that even my theological paradigm, the way of faith that I had been taught, was not sufficient to address the life of these suffering people. And so I reread the Bible. I started in the Old Testament. I read the whole thing again. And when I came to the Ten Commandments, I realized that the Ten Commandments is also the greatest commandment. Deuteronomy 6:5 says, if you love me, you know, you'll love the Lord your God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the summary report on the Ten Commandments. Have you noticed that? So if you're going to do the Ten Commandments, you prove that you love God. It's not an extra 11th. What it's saying is, do these things, and it means you got this thing. And so I read that, and I realized that, and then I realized, again, another theme popped out. I started looking for refugees in the Old Testament. Have you guys heard of the quartet of the vulnerable? The widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor? Have you heard of these people? If you read the Bible and you look for them, what you'll find is consistently their cause being replayed over and over again, especially as the acid test of mercy amongst the Hebrew tribe. So you get through the Ten Commandments and you read Deuteronomy, and you will start to see on like every couple chapters the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. And at the end of the book in Deuteronomy chapter 24, listen to this. This is what it says. It says, the following things you will do because I brought you out of Egypt. You were slaves, and you need to do this because you need to remember where you came from. And the following thing is this. Farmers, when you harvest your grains, you are not to harvest the edges or the corners of your fields. That belongs to the poor. Olive growers, you have worked hard. You are allowed to harvest your olives. You pass through your harvest one time. The second pass, those olives that are not quite ripe or even rotten, those belong to the poor. Now, to some of you here, that might sound like socialism. And you're just going to have to talk to God about that because that's what it says. Okay? And then the third time, he hits it three times with basically all of agriculture. He says to the grape growers, you get the first pass, harvest all your grapes, you've worked hard, fruit of the vine is yours. But the second pass, it belongs to the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. And then I came through Deuteronomy having this message and realizing that this is Rose. This is these refugees that we had begun working with. This is those children that I talked about in the first part of our little talk here. And I realized, wow, these people are in the Bible, and I'm supposed to love them. And I came to Leviticus. Now, Leviticus is a weird book, and I never really understood it. I just thought it was the social code or contract or the judicial code of the Hebrew tribe, the Jews. Well, it turns out that the summary of all those crazy commandments is this. You will love your neighbor as yourself. And guess who your neighbor is? It includes the quartet of the vulnerable, the widow, the alien, the orphan, and the poor. It's predictable. If you read the Old Testament, you will find it almost every time. When justice and righteousness are the foundation of his throne and rule, the kingdom of God, guess who gets to know first? Guess who proves that that's a fact? The most vulnerable people in our society. If they are loved, God loves us and he's with us. If they're not, he's probably going to kill you in very violent ways. That's the Old Testament. So then I went to the prophets, right? Now I always thought the prophets, you may like me have had some Pentecostal tendrils in your background. So and that's a mean thing to say. I mean, we all do this stuff, okay? But you may have some of this in your background, okay? The prophets are all about this. This is what I thought. The Hebrew aristocracy was unfaithful to God, went with their concubines or their, you know, their lovers or the wives that they took from the heathen or whatever, and they went up on the high places, set up fertility goddess worship, and were spiritual adulterers. And the call of the prophets is back to faithfulness, back to fidelity, back to this marriage of God and man, or woman, mankind, humankind, sorry. That's what I thought the prophets were about. Have you guys thought that? Well, I reread them again, looking for the refugees, and what I found is that the only way to make sense of the prophets is to understand that the prophets' anger is almost always revolving around the abuse of the poor. You trample on the widow, the alien, and the orphan, and the poor, and I don't like you. That's the prophet's message to the Hebrew tribe. If you question that, read Jeremiah, Zephaniah, read Ezekiel, read Isaiah. Isaiah is my favorite, and for me, Isaiah 58 is the white-hot core of primitive faith. Isaiah chapter 1, being a voice for the voiceless, caring for those who can't care for themselves. This is the proof of your goodness, children of Israel. That's what he says. Be a voice for them. And then all through the book of Isaiah, you've got this theme, okay? Well, you come to Isaiah 58, and what you have in my past is a nice, cheaply framed piece of art for your feature wall outside of your kitchen where you have learned about fasting. Isaiah 58, you know, with a pretty farm scene on it or someone at the table breaking bread, right? And I always thought this chapter was about how to fast, okay? How to fast. Fasting, did you know this? It's the key to spiritual rear end kicking. If you want to be super powerful and a force against the devil, you will fast. That's what I thought in my first couple years as a Christian. So I fasted a lot. One time, I fasted 7 days, all liquid fast. And I thought, man, I am so dynamite. I will purify this town. I'm from Fairbanks, Alaska. I will make all the demons run and hide. And furthermore, anyone gets near me and they start being exorcists, I will make it go away. And in fact, I went to Thailand in 1987 or 1986, and I thought, hey, I'm here. I can make all this stuff go away. And I based a lot of that on really strange interpretations of scriptures from the prophets, major and minor prophets, and especially on this chapter. Well, here's what I learned when I reread it. It doesn't say that at all. The only reason it references fasting is because that's what the Hebrew aristocracy was doing when Isaiah was prophesying. They celebrated the feasts with fasting. They broke the fast on gluttony. And guess who had to serve, clean, and build? The poor people. Okay? Furthermore, and here's the biggest thing. If you read this part of Isaiah, the biggest piece to understanding this part of Isaiah is that the Jewish aristocracy enjoyed a short period of peace between terrible war. And in that short period, as they have done many times before and as is our human tendency, they got used to the privilege of being the man. And they got used to living on the fat of the sacrifices made by the poor at the temple. And they got used to the wealth that was attendant with that, and they decided, we're going to have to build a temple. And so they built a temple to the God who set them free from slavery using what? You know, that's like, what? What are you thinking? You know, haven't they learned anything from the sons of Korah? Earth opens up and, you know, swallows 100,000 people. So the context of this chapter, Isaiah 58, to understand what's going on here, you have to understand that the poor are forced to pull double, triple shift. And if they show up late, they're fired. And if their kids are sick, they can't stay home. And so they die of preventable illnesses like tuberculosis. All of that was happening when Isaiah prophesied this. That was what was going on. And here's what he has to say. Is this not the kind of faith I have chosen? You want to be spiritual? You want to fast? You want to talk? How much do your words actually mean? They only mean as much as your behavior supports it. Was that you? He's my friend. Is this not the fasting, the faith I have chosen, to loose the chains of injustice and untie the cords of the yoke, to set the oppressed free and break every yoke? You know what that means? It means exactly what it says it means. And for 25 years, I spiritualized it. Spiritually oppressed people will be set free. People in spiritual bondage will be set free. Of course, that's part of our story. But that's not at all what's happening here. It has nothing to do with that. Is it not to share your food with the hungry and to provide the poor wanderer with shelter? That wanderer word goes back to alien or foreigner in the Old Testament. Wanderer. You know who those people are? We think, well, we got to just take care of our own family as Christians. Guess who the foreigner was? It's an illegal immigrant. It's a refugee. It's someone who's lost track or is running from violence or for other reasons is marginalized. That's who the foreigner is. We're supposed to help them. When you see the naked, to clothe them and not to turn away from your own flesh and blood, then you're light. See, then you're blessed. Then God is with you. But is God with you when we're a part of the oppressive, dirty, rotten system? Is God with us when we're not a part of setting the oppressed and the captives free? Then you will call and the Lord will answer. You will cry for help and he will say, "Here I am." He'll be there for us. If you do away with the yoke of oppression, set these people free with the pointing finger and malicious talk. And if you spend yourselves in behalf of the hungry and satisfy the needs of the oppressed, then your light will rise in the darkness and your night will be like the noonday sun. And then I went from there. I went from Isaiah and getting slapped around by Isaiah, jumped into Luke, right? Do you remember Luke chapter 4 where Jesus for the first time announces what he's all about? He says, "This is my mission. My mission is Isaiah 58. He quotes it. He picks up a scroll, unfurls the scroll, and reads that in another piece of Isaiah 61. Isaiah 61 says this, "The reason I'm here, the reason I am blessed by God or anointed is because of this. That's why I'm here." Did you catch that? His first message, his first public talk. Do you think that Jesus understood the significance of this passage? Do you think that he knew what was going on in the history of his people with the aristocracy building a temple to the God who set them free from slavery, having enslaved their own people and the foreigners among them? Yeah, Jesus knew what he was doing. And for me, that was a shocker. I realized that I had misunderstood Jesus, and suddenly passages like the sheep and the goats, Matthew 20, I never understood that except for anecdotal evidence in a debate. I never understood why Jesus said that, because what he seems to say is the only way you're going to heaven is if you feed the hungry. Read that when you go home. The only way to end up hanging out with Jesus is to clothe the naked, to give water to the thirsty. I never got it. I thought maybe the 35 scholars of the King James Council made a mistake there. They shouldn't have put that piece in there. And the same with James. James 1:27, what does it say? What is real religion? What is pure religion? It's caring for widows and orphans in their time of distress. It's keeping yourself from being polluted by the world and helping the most vulnerable people around us. That's called faith. And then if you get a little more into Jesus, he's asked how to go to heaven. "Hey, Jesus, how do you go to heaven?" What does he say? Well, you have to love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. You have to do for others what you would want done for you. It's not as complicated as the faith I learned as a young Christian, where I had to do all of these things and have all of these things in order for God to like me and not reject me. So then I skip to the killer, the one Bond Diller killer verse. You get to 1 John, right? Now, 1 John is combating the Gnostic heresy, that heresy that says that you can sin in your flesh and be pure in your spirit, that the spirit and the flesh are separate things. And what John does is said, no, they're not. Whatever you do in the flesh, you do in the spirit. Whatever you do in the spirit, you do in the flesh. It's repeating over and over again the greatest commandment that Jesus gave. Love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. If you love your neighbor, people know you love God. If you love God, you will love your neighbor. Over and over and over and over again. Well, I came to chapter 3, verses 16 through 18. And this is right after I made a commitment to, my wife and I made this commitment to Rose. Here's what it says. We know love because Jesus laid his life down for us, and we ought to lay our lives down too. And If we see material poverty, verse 17, if we see material poverty and close our heart against that story, how can we say that God's love is in us? And he said, let's not love with word and tongue, but let's love in action and deed, verse 18. When I read that, I was like, you gotta be kidding me. How did I miss this? It was there all along, but it's this up your fingernail with a needle kind of verse. Confronting all of my arrogance and the bubble that I had been floating in for 25 years. You know, I hope that I've encouraged you, because this, for me, this has been like the single most important thing that's come out of this work that we do. Understanding that it's so much more than talk. Our words mean nothing. In fact, they may even be bad if our actions are not congruent. If our actions don't live this love, if our actions don't reflect this compassion, we trivialize, and maybe even worse, the name of Jesus. I know I'm over time, but I'm going to take 5 more minutes of your time. Is that okay? I'm asking permission from you. Okay? You all know the DeRochers, Fran and Lori DeRocher. Fran just got back from Bangladesh, I think, today or yesterday. And you know that on August 26, 17 villages were attacked and set on fire. Did you know that? August 25th of last year. And this picture was taken from the sky, from a satellite, and it shows one of these village areas that was burned down. It was taken while the villages were on fire. This is one out of 17 villages on fire on August 25th. Between August 25th and the next couple of months, the Burma military and army, the Burma army and the state police rioted and themselves burned down 288 villages. This resulted in thousands of people being killed in the most brutal ways. If you want to have your senses assaulted, Google Rohingya violence, August 25th. See what you get. It's not pretty. And now mass graves are being unearthed. If you've watched the news, this is news right now. They're being unearthed, and they're finding that everything that has been reported by these fleeing people who flee to Bangladesh, it actually happened. So on the 27th, our team mobilized with your support and went to the Naf River. See, as the villages are attacked, people have time to run, some of them. And they run and they tell the next village and the next village that this is what happened, and then everybody's fleeing. It's the biggest exodus of human beings in our time from one country to another, into one ethnic group, one country to another. 688,000 is what the UN say. 688,000 Rohingya people have fled this kind of violence and ended up in Bangladesh. We showed up on the 27th and began helping those new arrivals as they came. One of the things about us, we work where politics and violence prevents compassion. And what that means is we go without permission. A lot of the places where there's war, if you ask for permission, you've got a 1 month to 6 month process where you have to ask permission to get to that place where the violence is happening. Pretty much you won't get permission to be where the violence is. You'll be able to help the survivors who make it out on the other side. In the case of Myanmar, asking permission is asking permission of the very people doing the killing. The government is doing the killing. And in Bangladesh, we knew that if we had asked for permission, we would not have received it for about 6 weeks. And that's exactly what the international community did. Those 6 weeks before the aid organizations came, we threw everything we had at Bangladesh, having people every other week landing on the ground at the banks of the river, handing out tarps, food, and provisions for these arrivals as they came, setting up water and temporary latrines and addressing the issues of their suffering. Now, that was rainy season, and we were helping people who had been in denial of calories since 2012. These are isolated communities who now are facing the final act of, of violence by their own government. And they make it, they cross the river, they collapse on the shore of the river. If we had the time, I could tell you story after story of our team members, my wife, trying to breathe life and hope and energy into a woman who couldn't lactate, couldn't feed her newborn baby, whose baby was born as her village was being attacked. She made it the two-week trek to the Naff River. She made it paying a trafficker with the rest of her village to cross that river. She made it to the bank of the river into our arms. The good news is that we get to be there and be good news. We get to be there and actually live out this Isaiah 58 thing. We sang worship songs that says we're not afraid. Evil cannot triumph over us. Nothing can stop us. Say a word and the blind can see. Say a word and people are healed. We sing these songs Sunday after Sunday. We have to go where those people suffer in order to see that goodness happen. Now, a lot of times it's just referring to our spiritual blindness. That's our habit in the West. But a lot of times we're quoting scriptures like this, Isaiah 58. We're quoting verses that talk about the white-hot core of faith, which is not asking the question, how dangerous is it and how are we going to pay for it? It's asking the question, what is the moral imperative and what does it mean to love my neighbor as I love myself? If that's my grandmother, if that's my child, if these are my three daughters, Elisa, Kristen, and Naomi, what would I do or what would I want? It suddenly becomes easy. It's not so complicated. You look into those eyes. I took his picture. Here's my vision for the future. Little kids that go to sleep knowing that they're secure, surrounded by a loving family, knowing that there will be food on the table in the morning and a school to go to the next day. Having the biochemical processes of nourishment that are taking place and taken for granted by me and my children, having it happen there in that little boy's life. All of the things that we as parents wish for our kids, I want to see that happen for kids who are affected by war, and I want those kids to understand that God has not departed from their fragile lives and that their parents are also being pursued by this reckless and muscular love. You look into his eyes, that's the future, that little boy. He wasn't meant to be a target. He was meant to be loved by God and by us. Rose Drive Church, you have faithfully been a part of this, and I am grateful. Continue, please, to share with us your resources and share with us at least Greg, if no one else. We really need Greg to be around. I don't know if you know, but Greg is our board chair. And continue to stand with us. And that's why I have these magazines. We send them out twice a year. We're very careful not to become spammy. These magazines are full of fuel for you to take to God and pray for these wonderful people that I've described. These Rohingya, these Syrian, and now these people in Yemen that we're helping. This magazine will help you pray. The thing I'm asking everyone for is your address. And we've got sign-up sheets out there, and we've got envelopes out there that you can give us your address, and you'll get this twice a year and an email once a month if you want to. Furthermore, we have a few copies of my wife's book left, and this'll get you into that white-hot core I've been referring to and help you really understand what Partners is all about and fundamentally how we started. So I encourage you to get one. They're $15, and 100% of that goes back to the children of Burma. Rose Drive Church, Rose Drive Friends Church, thank you for loving us. Thank you for being a part of the love that we're able to effectively demonstrate in some very dark places. Thank you for being light and being good news. Thank you very much.